Welcome back to 770 CHQR and More Than Money. And before the break, we were talking about U.S. equities, global equities. Where's the place to make money? What's the disciplined approach to get in and out of the stock market? I'm joined here with David Fingold, Vice President and Senior Portfolio Manager with Dynamic Funds. David, thank you for sticking around with us.
You're welcome.
So he's here live in the studio. I think what people have learned from you the last segment was that you have a process of getting in. More importantly, you have a process of getting out. And when you talk about some of these criteria, I don't think people really have that as a do-it-yourself investor. Many advisors, my peers in the industry, don't have that as a criteria. And many managers have a different approach than you do and may not be able to.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I supervise four other portfolio managers. I know quite a bit about portfolio manager behavior. I think one of the things we're most proud of is our ability to be emotionless when it comes to the sell discipline. It is not easy, and when we look at where others have failed, it's that difficulty in being emotionless. And I'm not going to suggest it's easy. It is in no way easy, but it is necessary.
Yeah, it is necessary. And so we've been hearing a lot about, in the news, China, U.S., mm-hmm. trade war, even the new NAFTA has come up again with the Democrats and the Republicans talking about that as we're heading into an election. And then, of course, the 2020 election with Trump and so forth and all that's happening.
So where should we start?
Where should we start? That's a very good question. You know, with all this, calling them the distractions, where do we start when it comes to your portfolio? Now, remember, our clients and people who are watching this are people who are transitioning to retirement or living in retirement. So volatility, your sell discipline really fits in well. The ability to reduce risk fits in. So many people are scared or concerned. Maybe they should just not be in the stock market because it's not worth it. Or they're trying to time the market because of all these events. Walk me through your thoughts from a macroeconomic perspective. Right. And where do you see things?
I think, first of all, everybody needs to be very careful about timing the market as far as politics and geopolitical events are concerned. And the main reason why I say it is that many of the events are just, you know, are positive, even though people assume that they're negative. So this is more of a sensitive topic, but if you actually go back and look how the market did, during and after the two Gulf Wars, the market went up. And certainly we saw that with the leave vote for Brexit, everybody thought that the market would go down, and it was a one-day-only event. The public, according to the flow of funds reports, had pulled a lot of money out of the market, and they were wrong. And similarly, a lot of money was pulled out of the market going into the 2016 presidential election. Again, people were wrong. So I'd start out with just understanding that a lot of the things the public are fearful about are not necessarily negative events. Many of them are positive events. I would also say, and I would probably quote Warren Buffett here and say that there's an exaggeration of the importance of politics in terms of how markets perform. As a generalization, if there's credit available in the economy, businesses want to grow. If you talk to most entrepreneurs, they will say that if we're not growing, we're going backwards. So the only thing that stops them from hiring and investing is whether or not the banks are going to make money available to them. So we look at credit markets, and credit markets tell us today that the economy should grow. I think another very important issue is the price of gasoline. Since 1954, we have not had a recession without the price of gasoline doubling or more in the 12 months prior.
And you're speaking of the U.S.?
I'm speaking of NYMEX gasoline futures. Okay. The reason why I'm doing it is because it's an easily available benchmark that we can actually check back over an extended period of time. Obviously, one gets distortions when you have some particular jurisdiction that has changed the taxes on gasoline. Sure. The other good thing about the NYMEX gasoline contract is it's a wholesale price, so it's not affected by taxation. So it gives us a clean read here. And what it really is a proxy on the cash flow of the consumer. I mean, most consumers do better if commodity prices go down because it means they have more change in their pocket after they fill up their tank, more change in their pocket after they buy their groceries. If interest rates go down, or stay the same, they don't have a drag from paying more interest on their debts. As long as there's more money in the consumer's pocket, they have tended to spend more. So when I see gasoline futures down on a year-over-year basis, and I checked yesterday, and that's where we were, it says to me in the next 12 months, no recession. So I get it that there's an election coming. I get it that there are trade discussions. Those are all things that can introduce volatility. But in terms of the overall direction, I'm not sure that they can change the overall direction. You know, but if you want, we can drill into any one of these issues.
Yeah. I was just curious about when you have these issues come up, do you make a decision or a play based upon what you may think will be the outcome of that? Let's pick U.S.-China trade deal. Assume that you think that the trade deal will go through in the next 12 months. There's going to be some sort of agreement. Would you make a play on that?
We would look for whether or not there's an asymmetry on that. So, for instance, there are American companies that do business in China. And I remember, for instance, with a company like Nike, that because they've done well in China, everybody was worried there'd be pushback and Chinese consumers would not want to buy Nike shoes. Our take on that would be it's exaggerated, it's 10% of their sales. Yes, it's part of the upside, and running shoes wear out. And a lot of companies have tried to compete with Nike, and over 30 or 40 years, what's been proven is it is very difficult to compete with Nike. So in that particular case, you actually have an asymmetry. What we would avoid is something where it could be catastrophic if we're wrong, like a company that really does a lot of business in China, and blacklisting would be a disaster for them. And again, I don't want to give you an example.
Sure.
But, there are several things we can do. One is look to where there's pessimism and the pessimism is overdone. The other thing would be to look for companies that actually benefit from what's happening in that respect. So the Chinese trade deal is perceived of as being very important. I think that for sentiment, it's important. But I've been clear that I thought that any deal would really just be a symbolic deal. The reason why I say that is because today, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, unit labor costs in Mexico are 20% lower than China. They're 30% lower in Vietnam, and they're 40% lower in the Philippines. So if you talk to major companies about where they're going to be sourcing product, they are all moving production out of China. They can't move it instantly, but they've been moving it very, very slowly. In fact, even where they use Chinese subcontractors, we are seeing increasing evidence that those Chinese subcontractors are moving the production to places like Bangladesh, and I even heard in one case Ethiopia, to try to move away from those high labor costs in China. So it sounds like the trade deal's a really big thing, and I'm sure it is for sentiment, but in the long term, China's not a competitive manufacturing country. So in the long term, no trade deal, yes trade deal, it's not going to change the outcome for China, which is that it has been slowing and it will continue to slow.
And that's a good segue to what's some of the indicators you see as what's slowing down. I actually had a note to talk to you about valuations of companies.
Mm-hmm.
But since you mentioned the processes, you look at the credit side of companies. And when you're going through your filtering process to see which companies fit and which ones don't in your criteria, are you seeing a lot of, I'm going to use the word, crappy companies out there with their poor credit situations?
Well, there are many of them. The market is not, I use the word monolithic, and what I'm trying to say when I say that is that the companies in the market are very, very highly differentiated. For instance, there's a lot of discussion about how much debt there is out there. And yes, there's a lot of corporate debt. Most of that corporate debt was piled on to companies that are private equity-sponsored companies. In fact, a huge part of the debt of the 3,000 largest companies in the United States is in a select group of companies, some of which were IPO'd out of private equity funds. The overall corporate universe in the United States is actually of tremendous quality in terms of its balance sheet, because the tremendous amounts of cash that are held by the average company are swamping the companies that have got the bad balance sheets. So we just avoid the companies with the bad balance sheets. The other thing is there are pockets of really attractive valuation within the market. I believe the overall market has a return on equity of approximately 20%. And I think that it has a debt to EBITDA, which is a credit measurement, of about 1.5 to 2 times. The technology sector, on an overall basis, has twice the profitability and has no net debt as an industry. So I get it that there are some cyclical issues on technology. I get it that there's a lot of sentiment around it because we're very emotional about things like which smartphone we like. But from a value and a quality point of view, there's a huge pocket of quality within technology, and that's why you've seen such significant exposure to technology within our portfolios.
Fantastic. So that's the process that you go through. There's the opportunity that lies, you know, we can be talking for hours about this. I'm so fascinated with what you do and how you've helped our clients achieve their retirement goals. So I want to thank you, David, for joining us. That's David Fingold, Vice President and Senior Portfolio Manager at Dynamic Fund. Well, that's the end of our show. Thank you for listening to More Than Money and 770CHQR. Now, remember our seminar on Tuesday, November 19th, 7 p.m. at the Four Points Sheraton Hotel. You need to reserve your seat, so give us a call, 966-8400. That's 966-8400, or you can register online at morethanmoneyradio.com. Thanks for listening, 770CHQR and More Than Money.
David Popowich and Faisal Carmelli are portfolio managers and investment advisors with CIBC Woodgundy in Calgary. The views of David Popowich and Faisal Carmelli do not necessarily reflect those of CIBC World Markets Inc. Clients are advised to seek advice regarding their particular circumstances from their personal tax and legal advisors. If you are currently a CIBC Woodgundy client, please contact your investment advisor. CIBC Woodgundy is a division of CIBC World Markets Inc., a subsidiary of CIBC and a member of the Canadian Investor Protection Fund and Investment Industry Regulatory Organization of Canada.